was sitting with. Did you kill my companion? My three interlocutors did not look up from the weaving they were doing on a crude loom. Yes, said the one I have come to think of as Alpha, because he had been the first to approach me in the forest. We cut your companion's throat with sharpened stones and held him down and silent while he struggled. He died the true death. Why? I asked after a moment. My voice sounded as dry as a corn husk crumbling. Why did he die the true death? Said Alpha, still not looking up. Because all of his blood ran out and he stopped breathing. No, I said. Why did you kill him? Alpha did not respond, but Betty, who may or may not be female and Alpha's mate, looked up from her loom and said simply, To make him die. Why? The responses invariably came back and just as invariably failed to enlighten me one iota. After much questioning, I had ascertained that they had killed Tuck to make him die, and that he had died because he had been killed. What is the difference between death and true death? I asked, not trusting the comlog or my temper at this point. The third Bikura, Del, grunted a response that the comlog interpreted as, Your companion died the true death. You did not. Finally, in frustration far too close to rage, I snapped, Why not? Why didn't you kill me? All three stopped in the middle of their mindless weaving and looked at me. You cannot be killed, because you cannot die, said Alpha. You cannot die because you belong to the cruciform and follow the way of the cross. I had no idea why the damn machine would translate cross 1 second, and as cruciform the next. Because you belong to the cruciform. A chill went through me, followed by the urge to laugh. Had I stumbled into that old adventure hollow cliché, the lost tribe that worshipped the god that had tumbled into their jungle, until the poor bastard cuts himself shaving or something, and the tribespeople, assured and a bit relieved at the obvious mortality of their visitor, offer up their erstwhile deity as a sacrifice? It would have been funny if the image of Tuck's bloodless face and raw-rimmed, gaping wound was not so fresh. Their reaction to the cross certainly suggested that I had encountered a group of survivors of a once Christian colony. Catholics? Even though the data in the comlog insisted that the dropship of 70 colonists who had crashed on this plateau 400 years ago had held only neo-Kirwin Marxists, all of whom should have been indifferent if not openly hostile to the old religions. I considered dropping the matter as being far too dangerous to pursue, but my stupid need to know drove me on. "Do you worship Jesus?" I asked. Their blank expressions left no need for a verbal negative. "Christ?" I tried again. "Jesus Christ? Christian? The Catholic Church?" No interest. "Catholic? Jesus? Mary? St. Peter? Paul? St. Tear?" The comlog made noises, but the words seemed to have no meaning for them. "You follow the cross," I said, flailing for some last contact. All three looked at me. "We belong to the cruciform," said Alpha. I nodded, understanding nothing. This evening I fell asleep briefly just before sunset. And when I awoke, it was to the organ pipe music of the cleft's nightfall winds. It was much louder here on the village ledges. Even the hovels seemed to join the chorus as the rising gusts whistled and whined through stone gaps, flapping fronds and crude smoke holes. Something was wrong. It took me a groggy minute to realize that the village was abandoned. Every hut was empty. I sat on a cold boulder and wondered if my presence had sparked some mass exodus. The wind music had ended, and meteors were beginning their nightly show through cracks in low clouds when I heard a sound behind me and turned to find all 70 of the 70 behind me. They walked past without a word and went to their huts. There were no lights. I imagined them sitting in their hovels, staring. I stayed outside for some time before returning to my own hut. After a while, I walked to the edge of the grassy shelf and stood where rock dropped away into the abyss. A cluster of vines and roots clung to the cliff face, but appeared to end a few meters into space and hang there above emptiness. No vine could have been long enough to offer a way to the river 2 kilometers below. But the Bikura had come from this direction. Nothing made sense. I shook my head and went back to my hut. Sitting here, writing by the light of a conlog diskey, I try to think of precautions I can take to ensure that I will see the sunrise. I can think of none. Day 103. The more I learn, the less I understand. I have moved most of my gear to the hut they leave empty for me here in the village. I have taken photographs, recorded video and audio chips, and imaged a full holo scan of the village and its inhabitants. They do not seem to care. I project their images and they walk right through them, showing no interest. I play back their words to them, and they smile and go back into their hovels to sit for hours, doing nothing, saying nothing. I offer them trade trinkets, and they take them without comment, check to see if they are edible, and then leave them lying. The grass is littered with plastic beads, mirrors, bits of colored cloth, and cheap pens. I have set up the full medical lab, but to no avail. The 70 will not let me examine them, will not let me take blood samples, even though I have repeatedly shown them that it is painless, will not let me scan them with the diagnostic equipment, will not, in short, cooperate in any way. They do not argue. They do not explain. They simply turn away and go about their non-business. After a week, I still cannot tell the males from the females. Their faces remind me of those visual puzzles that shift forms as you stare. Sometimes Betty's face looks undeniably female, and 10 seconds later, the sense of gender is gone, and I think of her, him, as Beta again. Their voices undergo the same shift. Soft, well-modulated, sexless. They remind me of the poorly programmed home comps one encounters on backward worlds. I find myself hoping to catch a glimpse of a naked Bikura. This is not easy for a Jesuit of 48 standard years to admit. Still, it would not be an easy task even for a veteran voyeur. The nudity taboo seems absolute. They wear the long robes while awake and during their 2-hour midday nap. They leave the village area to urinate and defecate, and I suspect that they do not remove the loose robes even then. They do not seem to bathe. One would suspect that this would cause olfactory problems, but there is no odor about these primitives except for the slight, sweet smell of chalma. "You must undress sometimes," I said to Alpha one day, abandoning delicacy in favor of information. "No," said Al, and went elsewhere to sit and do nothing while fully dressed. They have no names. I found this incredible at first, but now I am sure. "We are all that was and will be," said the shortest Bikura, one I think of as female and call Epi. "We are the 70. I searched the comlog records and confirmed what I suspected. In more than 16,000 known human societies, none are listed where there are no individual names at all. Even in the Lussis hive societies, individuals respond to their class category followed by a simple code. I tell them my name and they stare. Father Paul Doré. Father Paul Doré. Repeats the comlog translator, but there is no attempt at even simple repetition. Except for their mass disappearances each day before sunset, and their common 2-hour sleep time, they do very little as a group. Even their lodging arrangements appear random. Al will spend one nap time with Betty, the next with Gam, and the third with Zelda or Pete. No system or schedule is apparent. Every third day, the entire group of 70 goes into the forest to forage and returns with berries, chalma roots and bark, fruit, and whatever else might be edible. I was sure they were vegetarians until I saw Del munching on the cold corpse of an infant arboreal. The little primate must have fallen from the high branches. It seems, then, that the 70 do not disdain meat. They simply are too stupid to hunt and kill it. When the Bikura are thirsty, they walk almost 300 meters to a stream that cascades into the cleft. In spite of this inconvenience, there are no signs of water skins, jugs, or any type of pottery. I keep my reserve of water in 10-gallon plastic containers, but the villagers take no notice. In my plummeting respect for these people, I do not find it unlikely that they have spent generations in a village with no handy water source. "Who built the houses?" I ask. They have no word for village. "The 70," responds Will. I can tell him from the others only by a broken finger that did not mend well. Each of them has at least one such distinguishing feature, although sometimes I think it would be easier to tell crows apart. "When did they build them?" I ask, although I should know by now that any question that starts with "when" will not receive an answer. I receive no answer. They do go into the cleft each evening, down the vines. On the third evening, I tried to observe this exodus, but 6 of them turned me back from the edge and gently but persistently brought me back to my hut. It was the first observable action of the Bikura that had hinted at aggression, and I sat in some apprehension after they had gone. The next evening as they departed, I went quietly to my hut, not even peering out. But after they returned, I retrieved the imager and its tripod from where I had left them near the edge. The timer had worked perfectly. The hollows showed the Bikura grabbing the vines and scrambling down the cliff face as nimbly as the little arboreals that fill the chalma and werewood forests. Then they disappeared under the overhang. "What do you do when you go down the cliff each evening?" I asked Al the next day. The native looked at me with the seraphic Buddha smile I have learned to hate. "You belong to the cruciform," he said, as if that answered everything. "Do you worship when you go down the cliff?" I asked. No answer. I thought a minute. "I also follow the cross," I said, knowing that it would be translated as "belong to the cruciform." Any day now I will not need the translator program, but this conversation was too important to leave to chance. "Does this mean that I should join you when you go down the cliff face?" For a second I thought that Al was thinking. His brow furrowed, and I realized that it was the first time that I had seen one of the 70 come close to frowning. Then he said, "You cannot. You belong to the cruciform, but you are not of the 70. I realized that it had taken every neuron and synapse in his brain to frame that distinction. "What would you do if I did go down the cliff face?" I asked, expecting no response. Hypothetical questions almost always had as much luck as my time-based queries. This time he did respond. The seraphic smile and untroubled countenance returned, and Alpha said softly, If you try to go down the cliff, we will hold you down on the grass, take sharpened stones, cut your throat, and wait until your blood stops flowing and your heart stops beating. I said nothing. I wondered if he could hear the pounding of my heart at that moment. Well, I thought, at least you don't have to worry any longer that they think you are a god. The silence stretched. Finally, Al added one more sentence that I have been thinking about ever since. And if you did it again, he said, we would have to kill you again. We stared at each other for some time after that, each convinced, I am sure, that the other was a total idiot. Day 104. Each new revelation adds to my confusion. The absence of children here has bothered me since my first day in the village. Looking back through my notes, I find frequent mention of it in the daily observations I have dictated to my comlog, but no record of it in the personal mishmash here that I call a journal. Perhaps the implications were too frightening. To my frequent and clumsy attempts at piercing this mystery, the 70 have offered their usual enlightenment. The person questioned smiles beatifically and responds in some non sequitur that would make the babble of the web's worst village idiot seem like sage aphorisms in comparison. More often than not, they do not answer at all. One day I stood in front of the one I have tagged as Dell, stayed there until he had to acknowledge my presence and asked, "Why are there no children?"
"We are the 70, he said softly.
"Where are the babies?" No response. No sense of evading the question, merely a blank stare. I took a breath. "Who is the youngest among you?" Dell appeared to be thinking, wrestling with the concept. He was overmatched. I wondered if the Bikura had lost their time sense so completely that any such question was doomed. After a minute of silence, however, Dell pointed to where Al was crouched in the sunlight, working with his crude hand loom, and said, "There is the last one to return."
"To return?" I said. "From where?"
Dell stared at me with no emotion, not even impatience. "You belong to the cruciform," he said. "You must know the way of the cross." I nodded. I knew enough to recognize that in this direction lay one of the many conversational, illogic loops that usually derailed our dialogues. I hunted for some way to keep a grasp of the thin thread of information. "Then Al," I said and pointed, "is the last to be born, to return. But others will." "Return?" I was not sure that I understood my own question. How does one inquire about birth when the interviewee has no word for child and no concept of time? But Dell seemed to understand. He nodded. Encouraged, I asked, "Then when will the next of the 70 be born? Return?"
"No one can return until one dies," he said.
Suddenly, I thought I understood. "So, no new children. No one will be returned until someone dies," I said. "You replace the missing one with another to keep the group at 70. Dell responded with the type of silence I had come to interpret as assent. The pattern seemed clear enough. The Bikura were quite serious about their 70. They kept the tribal population at 70. The same number recorded on the passenger list of the dropship that crashed here 400 years ago. Little chance of coincidence there. When someone died, they allowed a child to be born to replace the adult. Simple. Simple but impossible. Nature and biology do not work that neatly.
Besides the problem of minimum herd population, there were other absurdities. Even though it is difficult to tell the ages of these smooth-skinned people, it is obvious that no more than 10 years separates the oldest from the youngest. Although they act like children, I would guess their average age to be in the late 30s or mid-40s in standard years. So where are the very old? Where are the parents, aging uncles, and unmarried aunts? At this rate, the entire tribe will enter old age at approximately the same time. What happens when they all pass beyond childbearing age and it comes time to replace members of the tribe? The Bikura lead dull, sedentary lives. The accident rate, even while living on the very edge of the cleft, must be low. There are no predators. The seasonal variations are minimal, and the food supply almost certainly remains stable. But granted all this, there must have been times in the 400-year history of this baffling group when disease swept the village, when more than the usual number of vines gave way and dropped citizens into the cleft, or when something caused that abnormal cluster of sudden deaths that insurance companies have dreaded since time immemorial. And then what? Do they breed to make up the difference and then revert to their current sexless behavior? Are the Bikura so different from every other recorded human society that they have a rutting period once every few years? Once a decade? Once in a lifetime? It is doubtful. I sit here in my hut and review the possibilities. One is that these people live very long lifetimes and can reproduce during most of that time, allowing for simple replacement of tribal casualties. Only this does not explain their common ages. And there is no mechanism to explain any such longevity. The best anti-aging drugs the hegemony has to offer only manage to extend an active lifetime a bit over the 100 standard year mark. Preventive health measures have spread the vitality of early middle age well into the late 60s, my age, but except for clonal transplants, bioengineering, and other perks for the very rich, no one in the world web can expect to begin planning a family when they are 70, or expect to dance at their 110th birthday party. If eating chalma roots or breathing the pure air of the Pinyin Plateau had a dramatic effect on retarding aging, it would be a sure bet that everyone on Hyperion would be living here munching chalma, that this planet would have had a Farcaster centuries ago, and that every citizen of the hegemony who has a universal card would be planning to spend vacations and retirement here. No. A more logical conclusion is that the Bikura live normal-length lives, have children at a normal rate, but kill them unless a replacement is required. They may practice abstinence or birth control, other than slaughtering the newborn, until the entire band reaches an age where new blood will soon be needed. A mass birthing time explains the apparent common age of the members of the tribe. But who teaches the young? What happens to the parents and other older people? Do the Bikura pass along the rudiments of their crude excuse for a culture, and then allow their own deaths? Would this be a true death, the rubbing out of an entire generation? Do the 70 murder individuals at both ends of the bell-shaped age curve? This type of speculation is useless. I am beginning to get furious at my own lack of problem-solving skills. Let's form a strategy here and act on it, Paul. Get off your lazy Jesuit ass. Problem: how to tell the sexes apart. Solution: cajole or coerce a few of these poor devils into a medical exam. Find out what all the sex role mystery and nudity taboo is about. A society that depends upon years of rigid sexual abstinence for population control is consistent with my new theory. Problem: why are they so fanatical about maintaining the same 70 population that the lost dropship colony started with? Solution: keep pestering them until you find out. Problem: where are the children? Solution: keep pressing and poking until you find out. Perhaps the evening excursion down the cliff is related to all of this. There may be a nursery there, or a pile of small bones. Problem: What is this belong to the cruciform and way of the cross business, if not a contorted vestige of the original colonists' religious belief? Solution. Find out by going to the source. Could their daily descent down the cliff be religious in nature? Problem. What is down the cliff face? Solution. Go down and see. Tomorrow, if their pattern holds true, all 70 of the 70 will wander into the woods for several hours of foraging. This time, I will not go with them. This time, I am going over the edge and down the cliff. Day 105. 09:30. Thank you, O Lord, for allowing me to see what I have seen today. Thank you, O Lord, for bringing me to this place at this time to see the proof of your presence. 1125. Edward. Edward. I have to return to show you all, to show everyone. I've packed everything I need, putting the imager discs and film in a pouch I wove from Bestus leaves. I have food, water, the mazer with its weakening charge, tent, sleep robes. If only the arrestor rods had not been stolen. The Bikura might have kept them. No. I've searched the hovels and the nearby forest. They would have no use for them. It doesn't matter. I leave today if I can, otherwise as soon as I can. Edouard, I have it all here on the film and discs. 1400. There is no way through the flame forests today. The smoke drove me back even before I penetrated the edge of the active zone. I returned to the village and went over the hollows. There is no mistake. The miracle is real. 15:30. The 70 will return any moment. What if they know? What if they can tell by looking at me that I have been there? I could hide. No. There is no need to hide. God did not bring me this far and let me see what I have seen, only to let me die at the hands of these poor children. 16:15. The 70 returned and went to their huts without giving me a glance. I sit here in the doorway of my own hut and cannot keep from smiling, from laughing, and from praying. Earlier I walked to the edge of the cleft, said Mass, and took communion. The villagers did not bother to watch. How soon can I leave? Supervisor Orlandi and Tuck had said that the flame forest was fully active for 3 local months, 120 days, then relatively quiet for 2. Tuck and I arrived here on day 87. I cannot wait another 100 days to bring the news to the world, to all of the worlds. If only a skimmer would brave the weather and flame forests and pluck me out of here. If only I could access one of the data fix sats that serve the plantations. Anything is possible. More miracles will occur. 23:50. The 70 have gone down into the cleft. The voices of the evening wind choir are rising all around. How I wish I could be with them now, there below. I will do the next best thing. I will drop to my knees here, near the cliff edge, and pray, while the organ notes of the planet and sky sing what I now know is a hymn to a real and present God. Day 106. I awoke today to a perfect morning. The sky was a deep turquoise. The sun was a sharp, blood-red stone set within. I stood outside my hut as the mists cleared. The arboreals ended their morning screech concert, and the air began to warm. Then I went in and viewed my tapes and discs. I realized that in yesterday's excited scribblings I mentioned nothing of what I found down the cliff. I will do so now. I have the discs, film tapes, and comm log notes, but there is always the chance that only these personal journals will be found. I lowered myself over the cliff edge at approximately 0730 hours yesterday morning. The Bikura were all foraging in the forest. The descent on vines had looked simple enough. They were bound around one another sufficiently to create a sort of ladder in most places. But as I swung out and began to let myself down, I could feel my heart pounding hard enough to be painful. There was a sheer 3,000-meter drop to the rocks and river below. I kept a tight grip on at least two vines at all times and centimetered my way down, trying not to look at the abyss beneath my feet. It took me the better part of an hour to descend the 150 meters that I am sure the Bikura can cover in 10 minutes. Eventually, I reached the curve of an overhang. Some vines trailed away into space, but most of them curled under the sheer slab of rock toward the cliff wall 30 meters in. Here and there, the vines appeared to have been braided to form crude bridges upon which the Bikura probably walked with little or no help from their hands. I crawled along these braided strands, clutching other vines for support and uttering prayers I had not said since my boyhood. I stared straight ahead, as if I could forget that there was only a seemingly infinite expanse of air under those swaying, creaking strands of vegetable matter. There was a broad ledge along the cliff wall. I allowed 3 meters of it to separate me from the gulf before I squeezed through the vines and dropped 2.5 meters to the stone. The ledge was about 5 meters wide, and it terminated a short distance to the northeast, where the great mass of the overhang began. I followed a path along the ledge to the southwest, and had gone 20 or 30 paces before I stopped in shock. It was a path. A path, worn out of solid stone. Its shiny surface had been pushed centimeters below the level of the surrounding rock. Farther on, where the path descended a curving lip of a ledge to a lower, wider level, steps had been cut into the stone, but even these had been worn to the point that they seemed to sag in the middle. I sat down for a second, as the impact of this simple fact struck me. Even 4 centuries of daily travel by the 80 could not account for such erosion of solid rock. Someone or something had used this path long before the Bikura colonists crashed here. Someone or something had used this path for millennia. I stood and walked on. There was little noise except for the wind blowing gently along the half-kilometer-wide cleft. I realized that I could hear the soft sound of the river far below. The path curved left, around a section of cliff and ended. I stepped out onto a broad apron of gently descending stone and stared. I believe I made the sign of the cross without thinking. Because this ledge ran due north and south for 100-meter cut of cliff, I could look due west along a 30-kilometer slash of cleft to open sky where the plateau ended. I realized at once that the setting sun would illuminate this slab of cliff wall under the overhang each evening. It would not have surprised me if, on the spring or autumn solstice, Hyperion's sun would, from this vantage point, appear to set directly into the cleft, its red sides just touching the pink-toned rock walls. I turned left and stared at the cliff face. The worn path led across the wide ledge to doors carved into the vertical slab of stone. No, these were not merely doors, they were portals. Intricately carved portals with elaborate stone casements and lintels. To either side of these twin doors spread broad windows of stained glass, rising at least 20 meters toward the overhang. I went closer and inspected the facade. Whoever had built this had done so by widening the area under the overhang, slicing a sheer, smooth wall into the granite of the plateau, and then tunneling directly into the cliff face. I ran my hand over the deeply cut folds of ornamental carving around the door. Smooth. Everything had been smoothed and worn and softened by time, even here, hidden away from most of the elements by the protective lip of overhang. How many thousands of years had this temple been carved into the south wall of the cleft? The stained glass was neither glass nor plastic, but some thick, translucent substance that seemed as hard as the surrounding stone to the touch. Nor was the window a composite of panels. The colors swirled, shaded, melded, and blended into one another like oil on water. I removed my flashlight from the pack, touched one of the doors, and hesitated as the tall portal swung inward with frictionless ease. I entered the vestibule. There is no other word for it. Crossed the silent 10-meter space and paused in front of another wall made from the same stained glass material that even now glowed behind me, filling the vestibule with thick light of 100 subtle hues. I realized instantly that at the sunset hour, the direct rays of the sun would fill this room with incredibly deep shafts of color, would strike the stained glass wall in front of me, and would illuminate whatever lay beyond. I found the single door, outlined by thin, dark metal, set into the stained glass stone, and I passed through it. On Pachem we have, as best we could from ancient photos and hollows, rebuilt the Basilica of St. Peter's exactly as it stood in the ancient Vatican. Almost 700 feet long and 450 feet wide, the church can hold 50,000 worshippers when His Holiness says Mass. We have never had more than 5,000 faithful there, even when the Council of Bishops of all the worlds is in assembly every 43 years. In the central apse near our copy of Bernini's Throne of St. Peter, the great dome rises more than 130 meters above the floor of the altar. It is an impressive space. This space was larger. In the dim light, I used the beams of my flashlight to ascertain that I was in a single great room. A giant hall, hollowed out of solid stone. I estimated that the smooth walls rose to a ceiling that must be only a few meters beneath the surface of the crag where the Bikura had set their huts. There was no ornamentation here, no furniture, no sign of any concession to form or function, except for the object that sat squarely in the center of this huge, echoing cave of a room. Centered in the great hall was an altar, a 5-meter square slab of stone left when the rest was hollowed out. And from this altar rose a cross. 4 meters high, 3 meters wide, carved in the old style of the elaborate crucifixes of old earth. The cross faced the stained glass wall as if awaiting the sun and the explosion of light that would ignite the inlaid diamonds, sapphires, blood crystals, lapis beads, queen's tears, onyxes, and other precious stones that I could make out in the light of the flashlight as I approached. I knelt and prayed. Shutting off the flashlight, I waited several minutes before my eyes could discern the cross in the dim, smoky light. This was, without a doubt, the cruciform of which the Bikura spoke. And it had been set here a minimum of many thousands of years ago, perhaps tens of thousands, long before mankind first left old earth, almost certainly before Christ taught in Galilee. I prayed. Today, I sit out in the sunlight after reviewing the hollow disks. I have confirmed what I barely noticed during my return up the cliff after discovering what I now think of as the basilica. On the ledge outside the basilica, there are steps descending farther into the cleft. Although not as worn as the path leading to the basilica, they are equally intriguing. God alone knows what other wonders wait below. I must let the worlds know of this find. The irony of my being the one to discover this is not lost on me. If it had not been for Armagast and my exile, this discovery might have waited more centuries. The church might have died before this revelation could have brought new life to it. But I have found it. One way or the other, I will leave or get my message out.
Day 107. I am a prisoner. This morning, I was bathing in my usual place, near where the stream drops over the cliff edge, when I heard a sound and looked up to see the Bikura I called Del staring at me with wide eyes. I called a greeting, but the little Bikura turned and ran. It was perplexing. They rarely hurry. Then I realized that even though I had been wearing trousers at the time, I had undoubtedly violated their nudity taboo by allowing Del to see me naked from the waist up. I smiled, shook my head, finished dressing, and returned to the village. If I had known what awaited me there, I would not have been amused. The entire 70 stood watching as I approached. I stopped a dozen paces from Al. "Good afternoon," I said. Alpha pointed, and half a dozen of the Bikura lunged toward me, seized my arms and legs, and pinned me to the ground. Beta stepped forward and removed a sharp-edged stone from his or her robes. As I struggled in vain to pull free, Beta cut my clothes down the front and pulled apart the shreds until I was all but naked. I ceased struggling as the mob pressed forward. They stared at my pale, white body and murmured to themselves. I could feel my heart pounding. "I am sorry if I have offended your laws," I began, "but there is no reason." "Silence," said Alpha, and spoke to the tall Bikura with the scar on his palm, the one I call Zed. "He is not of the cruciform." Zed nodded. "Let me explain," I began again, but Alpha silenced me with a backhanded slap that left my lip bleeding and my ears ringing. There had been no more sense of hostility in his action than I would have shown in silencing a comlog by throwing a switch.
"What are we to do with him?" asked Alpha. "Those who do not follow the cross must die the true death," said Beta, and the crowd shifted forward. Many had sharpened stones in their hands. "Those not of the cruciform must die the true death," said Beta,
and her voice held the tone of complacent finality common to oft-repeated formulae and religious litanies.
"I follow the cross," I cried out as the crowd tugged me to my feet. I grabbed at the crucifix that hung around my neck and struggled against the pressure of many arms. Finally, I managed to lift the little cross over my head. Alpha held up his hand and the crowd paused. In the sudden silence, I could hear the river 3 kilometers below in the cleft.
"He does carry a cross," said Alpha.
Del pressed forward.
"But he is not of the cruciform. I saw. It was not as we thought. He is not of the cruciform."
There was murder in his voice. I cursed myself for being careless and stupid. The future of the church depended upon my survival, and I had thrown both away by beguiling myself into believing that the Bikura were dull, harmless children.
"Those who do not follow the cross must die the true death," repeated Beta.
It was a final sentencing. Stones were being raised by 70 when I shouted, knowing that it was either my last chance or my final condemnation. "I have been down the cliff and worshipped at your altar. I follow the cross." Alpha and the mob hesitated. I could see that they were wrestling with this new thought. It was not easy for them.
"I follow the cross and wish to be of the cruciform," I said as calmly as I could. "I have been to your altar."
"Those who do not follow the cross must die the true death," called Gamma.
"But he follows the cross," said Alpha. "He has prayed in the room."
"This cannot be," said Zed. "The 70 pray there, and he is not of the 70.
"We knew this before, that he is not of the 70, said Alpha, frowning slightly as he dealt with the concept of past tense.
"He is not of the cruciform," said Delta 2.
"Those who are not of the cruciform must die the true death," said Beta.
"He follows the cross," said Alpha. "Can he not then become of the cruciform?"
An outcry arose. In the general babble and shuffle of forms, I pulled against restraining hands, but their grips remained firm.
"He is not of the 70 and is not of the cruciform," said Beta, sounding more puzzled than hostile now.
"How is it that he should not die the true death? We must take the stones and open his throat so that the blood flows until his heart stops. He is not of the cruciform."
"He follows the cross," said Alpha. "Can he not become of the cruciform?"
This time silence followed the question.
"He follows the cross and has prayed at the room of the cruciform," said Alpha. "He must not die the true death."
"All die the true death," said a Bikura, whom I did not recognize.
My arms were aching from the strain of holding the crucifix above my head.
"Except the 70, finished the anonymous Bikura.
"Because they followed the cross, prayed at the room, and became of the cruciform," said Alpha. "Must he not then become of the cruciform?"
I stood there, gripping the cold metal of the small cross, and awaited their verdict. I was afraid to die. I felt afraid. But the larger part of my mind seemed almost detached. My greatest regret was that I would not be able to send out the news of the Basilica to an unbelieving universe.
"Come, we will talk of this,"
Beta said to the group, and they pulled me with them as they trod silently back to the village. They have imprisoned me here in my hut. There was no chance to try for the hunting maser. Several of them held me down while they emptied the hut of most of my possessions. They took my clothing, leaving me only one of their rough-woven robes to cover myself with. The longer I sit here, the more angry and anxious I become. They have taken my comlog, imager, discs, chips, everything. I have a single, unopened crate of medical diagnostic equipment left up at the old site, but that cannot help me document the miracle in the cleft. If they destroy the things they have taken, and then destroy me, there will be no record of the Basilica. If I had a weapon, I could kill the guards and... Oh, dear God, what am I thinking? Edward, what am I to do? And even if I survive this, make my way back to Keats, arrange travel back to the web, who would believe me? After 9 years' absence from Pachem because of the quantum leap time debt, just an old man returning with the same lies he was exiled for. Oh, dear God, if they destroy the data, let them destroy me as well. Day 110. After 3 days, they have decided my fate. Zed, and the one I think of as Theta Prime, came to get me shortly after midday. I blinked as they led me out into the light. The 70 stood in a wide semicircle near the cliff edge. I fully expected to be thrown over that edge. Then I noticed the bonfire. I had assumed that the Bikura were so primitive that they had lost the art of making and using fire. They did not warm themselves with fire, and their huts were always dark. I had never seen them cook a meal, not even the rare corpse of an arboreal they devoured. But now the fire was burning strongly, and they were the only ones who could have started it. I looked to see what fueled the flames. They were burning my clothes, my comlog, my field notes, the tape cassettes, video chips, data disks, the imager, everything that had held information. I screamed at them, tried to throw myself at the fire, and called them names I had not used since the street days of my childhood. They ignored me. Finally, Alpha came close.
"You will become of the cruciform," he said softly.
I did not care. They led me back to my hut, where I wept for an hour. There is no guard at the door. A minute ago I stood at the doorway and considered running for the flame forests. Then I thought of a much shorter but no less fatal run to the cleft. I did nothing.
The sun will be setting in a short time. Already the winds are rising. Soon. Soon. Day 112. Has it been only 2 days? It has been forever. It did not come off this morning. It did not come off. The med scanner's image wafer is right here in front of me, but I still cannot believe it. And yet I do. I am of the cruciform now. They came for me just before sunset, all of them. I did not struggle as they led me to the edge of the cleft. They were more agile on the vines than I could have imagined. I slowed them down, but they were patient, showing me the easiest footholds, the fastest route. Hyperion's sun had dropped below low clouds and was visible above the rim wall to the west as we walked the final few meters to the basilica. The evening wind song was louder than I had anticipated. It was as if we were caught amid the pipes of a gigantic church organ. The notes rose from bass growls so deep that my bones and teeth resonated in sympathy to high, piercing screams that slid easily into the ultrasonic. Alpha opened the outer doors, and we passed through the antechamber into the central basilica. The 70 made a wide circle around the altar and its tall cross. There was no litany. There was no singing. There was no ceremony. We simply stood there, in silence, as the wind roared through the fluted columns outside and echoed in the great empty room carved into the stone, echoed and resonated and grew in volume until I clapped my hands over my ears. And all the while the streaming, horizontal rays of sunlight filled the hall with deepening hues of amber, gold, lapis, and then amber again. Colors so deep that they made the air thick with light and lay like paint against the skin. I watched as the cross caught this light and held it in each of its 1,000 precious stones, held it, it seemed, even after the sun had set and the windows had faded to a twilight gray. It was as if the great crucifix had absorbed the light and was radiating it toward us, into us. Then, even the cross was dark, and the winds died, and in the sudden dimness, Alpha said softly, "Bring him along." We emerged onto the wide ledge of stone, and Beta was there with torches. As Beta passed them out to a selected few, I wondered if the Bikura reserved fire for ritual purposes only. Then Beta was leading the way, and we descended the narrow staircase carved into the stone. At first I crept along, terrified, clutching at the smooth rock and searching for any reassuring projection of root or stone. The drop to our right was so sheer and endless that it bordered on being absurd. Descending the ancient staircase was far worse than clutching at vines on the cliff face above. Here I had to look down each time I placed a foot on the narrow, age-slickened slabs. A slip and fall at first seemed probable, then inevitable. I had the urge to stop then, to return at least to the safety of the basilica, but most of the 70 were behind me on the narrow staircase, and there seemed little chance that they would stand aside to let me pass. Besides this, and even greater than my fear, was a nagging curiosity about what was at the bottom of the staircase. I did pause long enough to glance up at the lip of the cleft, 300 meters above, and to see that the clouds were gone. The stars were out, and the nightly ballet of meteor trails was bright against a sable sky. Then I lowered my head, began a whispered recitation of the rosary, and followed the torchlight and the Bikura into the treacherous depths. I could not believe that the staircase would take us all the way to the bottom of the cleft. But it did. When? Sometime after midnight. I realized that we would be descending all the way down to the level of the river. I estimated that it would take us until noon of the next day. But it did not. We reached the base of the cleft shortly before sunrise. The stars still shone in the aperture of sky between cliff walls that rose an impossible distance on either side. Exhausted, staggering downward step by step, recognizing slowly that there were no more steps, I stared upward and wondered stupidly if the stars remained visible there in the daylight, as they did in a well I had lowered myself into once as a child in Villefranche-sur-Saône. "Here," said Beta. It was the first word uttered in many hours, and was barely audible over the roar of the river. The 70 stopped where they were and stood motionless. I collapsed to my knees and fell on my side. There was no possibility that I could climb that stairway we had just descended. Not in a day. Not in a week. Perhaps never. I closed my eyes to sleep, but the dull fuel of nervous tension continued to burn inside me. I looked out across the floor of the ravine. The river here was wider than I had anticipated, at least 70 meters across. And the noise of it was beyond mere noise. I felt that I was being consumed by a great beast's roar. I sat up and stared at a patch of darkness in the opposing cliff wall. It was a shadow darker than the shadows, more regular than the serrated patchwork of buttresses and crevices and columns that mottled the face of the cliff. It was a perfect square of darkness, at least 30 meters to a side. A door or hole in the cliff wall. I struggled to my feet and looked downriver along the wall we had just descended. Yes, it was there. The other entrance, the one toward which Beta and the others even now were walking, was faintly visible in the starlight. I had found an entrance to Hyperion's labyrinth.
"Did you know that Hyperion was one of the 9 labyrinthine worlds?" someone had asked me on the dropship.
"Yes. It was the young priest named Hoyt." I had said yes and dismissed the fact. I was interested in the Bikura. Actually, more in the self-inflicted pain of my own exile, not the labyrinths or their builders. 9 worlds have labyrinths. 9. Out of 176 web worlds, and another 200-some colonial and protectorate planets. 9 worlds. Out of 8,000 or more worlds explored, however cursorily, since the Hegira. There are planetary archaeohistorians who devote their lives to the study of the labyrinths. Not I. I had always found them a sterile topic, vaguely unreal. Now I walked toward one, with the 70 as the Khan's River roared and vibrated, and threatened to douse our torches with its spray. The labyrinths were dug, tunneled, created more than 750,000 standard years ago. The details were inevitably the same, their origins inevitably unsolved. Labyrinthine worlds are always Earth-like, at least to 7.9 on the Solmev scale, always circling a G-type star, and yet always restricted to worlds that are tectonically dead. More like Mars than old Earth. The tunnels themselves are set deep, usually a minimum of 10 kilometers, but often as deep as 30. And they catacomb the crust of the planet. On Svoboda, not far from Pachem system, over 800,000 kilometers of labyrinth have been explored by remotes. The tunnels on each world are 30 meters square and carved by some technology still not available to the hegemony. I read once in an archaeological journal that Kemp Holzer and Weinstein had postulated a fusion tunneler that would explain the perfectly smooth walls and lack of tailings. But their theory did not explain where the builders or their machines had come from or why they had devoted centuries to such an apparently aimless engineering task. Each of the labyrinthine worlds, including Hyperion,
has been probed and researched. Nothing has ever been found. No signs of excavation machinery, no rusting miners' helmets, not a single piece of shattered plastic or decomposing stimstick wrapper. Researchers have not even identified entrance and exit shafts. No suggestion of heavy metals or precious ores has been sufficient to explain such a monumental effort. No legend or artifact of the labyrinth builders has survived. The mystery had mildly intrigued me over the years, but never concerned me. Until now. We entered the tunnel mouth. It was not a perfect square. Erosion and gravity had turned the perfect tunnel into a rough cave for 100 meters into the cliff wall. Beta stopped just where the tunnel floor grew smooth and extinguished his torch. The other Bikura did likewise. It was very dark. The tunnel had turned enough to block out any starlight that might have entered. I had been in caves before. With the torches extinguished, I did not expect my eyes to adapt to the near-total darkness. But they did. Within 30 seconds, I began to sense a roseate glow. Dim at first, then ever richer until the cave was brighter than the canyon had been. Brighter than Pachem under the glow of its triune moons. The light came from 100 sources, 1,000 sources. I was able to make out the nature of these sources, just as the Bikura dropped reverently to their knees. The cave walls and ceiling were encrusted with crosses, ranging in size from a few millimeters to almost 1 meter long. Each glowed with a deep pink light of its own. Invisible in the torchlight, these glowing crosses now suffused the tunnel with light. I approached one embedded in the wall nearest me, 30 or so centimeters across. It pulsed with a soft, organic glow. This was not something that had been carved out of stone or attached to the wall. It was definitely organic, definitely alive, resembling soft coral. It was slightly warm to the touch. There came the slightest whisper of sound. No, not sound. A disturbance in the cool air, perhaps. And I turned in time to see something enter the chamber. The Bikura were still kneeling, their heads down, eyes lowered. I remained standing. My gaze never left the thing which moved among the kneeling Bikura. It was vaguely man-shaped, but in no way human. It stood at least 3 meters tall. Even when it was at rest, the silvered surface of the thing seemed to shift and flow like mercury suspended in midair. The reddish glow from the crosses set into the tunnel walls reflected from sharp surfaces and glinted on the curved metal blades protruding from the thing's forehead. 4 wrists, oddly jointed elbows, knees, armored back, and thorax. It flowed between the kneeling Bikura, and when it extended 4 long arms, hands extended but fingers clicking into place like chrome scalpels, I was absurdly reminded of His Holiness on Pachem offering a benediction to the faithful. I had no doubt that I was looking at the legendary Shrike. At that moment I must have moved or made a sound, for large red eyes turned my way, and I found myself hypnotized by the dance of light within the multifaceted prisms there. Not merely reflected light, but a fierce, blood-bright glow, which seemed to burn within the creature's barbed skull and pulse in the terrible gems set where God meant eyes to be. Then it moved. Or rather, it did not move, but ceased being there and was here. Leaning less than 1 meter from me, its oddly jointed arms encircling me in a fence of body blades and liquid silver steel. Panting hard but unable to take a breath, I saw my own reflection, face white and distorted, dancing across the surface of the thing's metallic shell and burning eyes.
I confess that I felt something closer to exultation than fear. Something inexplicable was happening. Forged in Jesuit logic and tempered in the cold bath of science, I nevertheless understood at that second the ancient obsession of the God-fearing for another kind of fear. The thrill of exorcism, the mindless whirl of dervish possession, the puppet dance ritual of tarot, and the almost erotic surrender of seance, speaking in tongues, and Zen Gnostic trance. I realized at that instant just how surely the affirmation of demons or the summoning of Satan somehow can affirm the reality of their mystic antithesis, the God of Abraham. Thinking none of this but feeling all of it, I awaited the embrace of the Shrike with the imperceptible tremble of a virgin bride. It disappeared. There was no thunderclap, no sudden smell of brimstone, not even a scientifically sound inrush of air. 1 second the thing was there, surrounding me with its beautiful certainty of sharp-edged death. And the next instant, it was gone. Numbed, I stood there and blinked as Alpha rose and approached me in the Bosch-tinted gloom. He stood where the Shrike had stood, his own arms extended in a pathetic imitation of the deadly perfection I had just witnessed. But there was no sign on Alpha's bland, Bikura face that he had seen the creature. He made an awkward, open-handed gesture which seemed to include the labyrinth, cave wall, and scores of glowing crosses embedded there. "Cruciform," said Alpha. The 70 rose, came closer, and knelt again. I looked at their placid faces in the soft light, and I also knelt.
"You will follow the cross all of your days," said Alpha,
and his voice carried the cadence of litany. The rest of the Bikura repeated the statement in a tone just short of a chant.
"You will be of the cruciform all of your days," said Alpha.
And as the others repeated this, he reached out and pulled a small cruciform away from the cave wall. It was not more than 12 centimeters long, and it came away from the wall with the faintest of snaps. Its glow faded even as I watched. Alpha removed a small thong from his robe, tied it around small knobs at the top of the cruciform, and held the cross above my head.
"You will be of the cruciform now and forever," he said.
"Now and forever," echoed the Bikura.
"Amen," I whispered. Beta signaled that I should open the front of my robe. Alpha lowered the small cross until it hung around my neck. It felt cool against my chest. The back of it was perfectly flat, perfectly smooth. The Bikura stood and wandered toward the cave entrance, apparently apathetic and indifferent once again. I watched them leave, and then I gingerly touched the cross, lifted and inspected it. The cruciform was cool, inert. If it had truly been living a few seconds earlier, it showed no sign of it now. It continued to feel more like coral than crystal or rock. There was no sign of any adhesive material on the smooth back of it. I speculated on photochemical effects that would have created the luminescent quality. I speculated on natural phosphors, bioluminescence, and on the chances that evolution would shape such things. I speculated on what, if anything, their presence here had to do with the labyrinth, and on the eons necessary to raise this plateau so the river and canyon could slice through one of the tunnels. I speculated on the basilica and its makers,